Mark, did you run across anything new, different while you were doing the research for the book on the Twilight Zone?
Oh yeah, lots of stuff. It was really a treasure trove. It's just very fun to be able to say, well, when I was crawling through Rod Serling's attic, I found, and that's literal because I spent many a day there up in his attic. Because when I started working on the Twilight Zone Companion, it was 2 years after Serling had passed away, and so everything at his house was exactly as he left it. The Emmys were all there, all the different awards. Even his dog was still there. And one day I was up in his attic, and there was a box that was not labeled, and I opened it up, and inside it was filled with Twilight Zone scripts that were written for the show but not made. And there were scripts by Serling and by Richard Matheson and two by Ray Bradbury and wonderful scripts. In fact, the one I found by Richard Matheson was ultimately made as an episode of Amazing Stories, and it won John Lithgow an Emmy.
Oh, my. Now, why weren't they made?
There were different reasons. For instance, with the Ray Bradbury scripts, it was mainly that they were written for a level of special effects that really didn't exist in the early 60s. They were ahead of their time. But one of them, A Miracle of Rare Device, which is a marvelous script, I hope to make myself someday as I move through showrunning different series and directing different films.
Well, the mind of Rod Serling never stopped, did it?
No, he was always creative, always active. It's fascinating when I actually got a hold of video and audio tapes of him teaching classes on writing, and he would frequently bring a 16mm print of a Twilight Zone episode and screen it, and then talk about how he came up with the ideas. He could be in a bus station and see someone across the room, and suddenly he'd have an idea, or he could be walking in a park or walking on the back lot at MGM, or get a brochure in the mail about something, such as at one point he got a brochure about an interior of an airliner that could be used as a set. He got that one day, and his brother Bob was visiting, and Serling got very thoughtful, and he said to Bob, you drive my car, and I just need to think for a few minutes. And Bob was astonished because Rod never let anyone drive his car. It was an Excalibur. It was a very fancy car.
Oh, yeah.
And Rod said, you know, what would happen if an airplane hit a slipstream and suddenly it went faster than the plane had ever gone before and it found itself back in time? And that, of course, became a terrific episode called The Odyssey of Flight 33.
Was that the one where they saw dinosaurs on Manhattan Island?
Yes,
remember that.
Yes, and Twilight Zone, of course, specialized in those great images, those moments that are just burned into your mind.
Well, what he did is he took real-life events or current events and he turned them into the imagination that so many of us just fell in love with.
Yes. Well, that was where his genius was, because so many of these stories are things that you've never seen before. So it was that thing of looking at the world slightly tilt, and Serling just was. It was ironic because if not for the censorship that had forced him into the Twilight Zone, he never actually would have come up with his great, great masterpiece.
How did he end up being the talent on the Twilight Zone?
Well, it's hilarious because originally they didn't intend for Rod to be the host. In fact, the first version of the pilot of Twilight Zone, Where Is Everybody? The first version had a man named Westbrook von Voorhees as the narrator, and he had done The March of Time, and he had this big booming voice, and when you see that thing, it's just totally wrong. And everyone who looked at the pilot, and this version never aired, of course, so they were saying, okay, well, who can we get? And they thought, well, maybe we can get Orson Welles, but he wanted too much money. And finally, they were all sitting around a table, all these executives and so forth, and Serling said, well, how about me? And they practically fell out of their chair laughing. Serling, for one thing, had never acted professionally. He had acted in drama club back in high school. But ultimately, it was sort of the last choice, and they used Rod. And in fact, the first season, he wasn't on camera. They just used his voice. But slowly but surely, it was clear that he really was the perfect choice.
Mark, how did the music come about? Because the music is so synonymous with the Twilight Zone.
Yes.
When you hear that, that's the first thing you remember.
That's
and
right.
It was just so well done.
Yes. Well, well, the music all through the series is terrific. The familiar theme was by a composer named Marius Constant, who was actually a French avant-garde composer that they came upon, and of course it was a perfect match. But also Bernard Herrmann, who wrote the music for Citizen Kane and Psycho and great Hitchcock movies and Taxi Driver, he did a lot of great music for Twilight Zone. Jerry Goldsmith, who later went on to become a major film composer, he did Planet of the Apes and many other films composed for Twilight Zone. So they really, basically, first of all, they would take people who were just at the top of their form in every area, from makeup to acting to directing to music, etc. But also, again, the scripts that Serling was writing, and George Clayton Johnson and Richard Matheson and Charles Beaumont and the others, when you got a script that was of such enormous quality, it got you so excited that you would do work that you'd never done before.
When they wrote the scripts, were they thinking of actors for the script?
Sometimes, yes. For instance, on the Twilight Zone episodes that Rod Serling wrote that star Burgess Meredith, he was very much thinking of Burgess Meredith. And same with Jack Klugman, who did four episodes. Sometimes it would be an actor that the casting director had seen in some play in Los Angeles or in New York, and they would be perfect. It varied. But it's funny because there was a letter that Charles Beaumont wrote to Rod Serling. Beaumont had written a Twilight Zone episode called A Nice Place to Visit, in which a mobster dies and finds himself in what he thinks is heaven, but what turns out to be hell. And in the episode, as it was filmed, it starred Larry Blyden, who was quite a competent comedic actor. But in the letter, Charles Beaumont was suggesting that Rod play the gangster himself. So it was, Beaumont was quick to point out that he didn't think of Serling as inherently a dishonest type.
And the programs were just fantastic. I remember one, for example, where everyone was huddled around a woman for the entire program, talking about how horrible she looked,
yes,
and ugly, and she turned out to be gorgeous.
Yes.
They were the ones that looked bad.
That was Eye of the Beholder, and it's a remarkable piece of work. Doug Hayes directed it. He was one of the great directors of the Twilight Zone. An interesting aspect of that episode that most people didn't know, in fact, I don't think anyone knew about it other than those who had actually made the episode before I wrote The Twilight Zone Companion, was that, as you mentioned, George, for most of the episode, this woman's head is wrapped in bandages, and she's supposedly hideously ugly, and she's waiting to see if surgery has corrected her appearance. And there were actually two actresses who played that role in the episode, because when she's unwrapped, she's beautiful, and everyone else is hideously ugly. And that was played by Donna Douglas, who later played Ellie Mae on the Beverly Hillbillies.
Okay.
But in reality, when her head is wrapped up, it's a different actress. Her name, a woman named Maxine Stewart, who had a very expressive voice. And Doug Hayes realized that getting a beautiful actress who could also act that brilliantly would be virtually impossible. So he played that trick where it was two actresses.